Welcome to the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week. Glad you could be here with us. And Peter Green of Infostar.com comes by every month to talk about personal computers. And we'll definitely be talking about general computer issues. But Peter just got back from a big overseas trip, and he wants to share some of the things he learned in planning it and how some websites have really developed over the years and are much more useful, and some websites that you might not stumble across without him letting you know they're out there. So, Peter, thanks so much for coming in.
Always my pleasure. It's great.
So tell us where you were and what you did.
We got together in Thanksgiving, and my two adult children, ages 19 and 22, I said, you know, I want to take you guys on a nice trip for 2 weeks. Where do you want to go? And we tabled a number of different places. One was Japan, and one was New Zealand. Another one was, you know, going back to Europe where we were 7 years ago. And my daughter said Greek islands, and so I started looking into that, and we collectively agreed, okay, that sounds good, and where? Because there's so many of them, and they're divided up in different basically sectors or whatever you want to call them, but they're grouped based on historical periods and things like that. So anyhow, started reading blogs, started reading travel guides, and all this stuff is listed on the as part of the top 10. I try to summarize it as best as possible. But I would probably say the most invaluable tool was using Google Earth, which allows you to see the proximal relationship between places and making choices about, okay, I want to go here, and then I want to go here next, and then here next. You know, to be able to understand the relationship between whether or not you're going east and west, north and south, and how far.
Uphill, downhill.
Uphill, downhill, yeah. And getting an idea what the region looks like, you know, what the places look like, because people post pictures. And, you know, looking at the relationship between airport and hotel, beaches and hotel, port and hotel if you're going to use a ferry, hotel to hotel, you know, if it's a you know, a large area you're going to cover. So just being able to see that, and you're kind of flying, you have this fly-in feel, it just gives you a better understanding about, you know, what you can do and what you really can't do.
Or what you might want to do, but you might want to think of a different way to do it.
That's right. And I didn't use that the last time I planned the trip, but this time it just made things so much more easier to understand and make, you know, better decisions.
How widespread is Google Earth coverage? I mean,
All over.
So it really doesn't matter. It's not like something where you're relying on other travelers necessarily having been there to take pictures or give reviews of places. There's also satellite information.
Yeah, that helps. But, you know, when you zoom in on the Greek islands, and there are, you know, there's this whole section in the Aegean Sea, you know, between Athens and or Greece and Turkey, in that whole region and north of Crete, you know, you can zoom in on any aspect of it and, you know, just see the lay of the land by satellite. Mm-hmm. And then also people post pictures to share. The other part that kind of caught me off guard were a couple of things. One is using the financial aspect. If you're a member of like the UW Credit Union, that worked flawlessly in terms of using the debit card and, you know, your personal PIN number and using ATMs and being charged a 1% transaction fee and then what the standard exchange rate was. That was flawless, and I commend them for making that so easy to be able to do that. The interesting problem in Greece is, based on the state of their economy, is the ATMs would dish out $50 euro bills, and a lot of the vendors didn't have change to deal with that. So they'd be, oh, do you have anything smaller? Or, you know, wait, I have to run out and get change, and then they'd come back and actually give you more money back because they'd rather give you more money back than less money back. So that happened 4 or 5 times in one day, and that caught me off guard.
I think that's often the case because, yeah, the machines tend to spit out the biggest denominations they can.
We were there, you know, right when the tourism season is just getting started. So I can only, you know, it's got to be crazy when things are going on from now all the way through the end of the summer in terms of dealing with that. The other thing was, in terms of making online purchases, both from, you know, just being here in the States, but purchasing airline tickets and other things online that were occurring in Europe, the Visa company here was questioning my online purchases that I was making there. And rather than them picking up the phone, they allowed one to go through and then they blocked it. And then the systems didn't handshake. So when I spoke to them and they said, well, we'll reset it, the system I was trying to deal with was not handshaking. In other words, they were not immediately communicating and resetting so that I could go ahead and complete the transaction. So I had to find an alternative way to go around that because, you know, otherwise I couldn't buy the tickets I needed. The other thing is in terms of I needed to make some IT purchases through eBay and using PayPal. PayPal has a travel component in your profile. So I was able to make my first transaction, and even though the product was being shipped to me, they're still monitoring, you know, where requests are coming from, and they didn't shut my account down, but they wouldn't allow me to do the transaction. So I was in this endless loop of not being able to complete this, you know, the purchase.
They basically put a hold on your account. Yeah.
Well, they didn't put a hold on it. They just wouldn't let me go through the normal procedure. So what I did was I circumvented that by contacting the seller directly, telling them to give me their email, PayPal address, and then I could send them money that way. So I was able to circumvent, get around it, but at the same time, I had no idea, you know, that PayPal had instituted something like that because the product is still being shipped to me. So I was like, if I'm paying for it and it's still being shipped to me, why aren't they allowing me to do it? But anyhow, that's how that works.
So actually, I want to go back to what you were just saying. So one of the tips that you put on this month's top 10 list, and there is a link to that on our Facebook page at infostar.com. If you go to the main page, you can always go to current top 10 on the left side. So you advise letting your credit card companies know, anyone who's going to be on the other end of those transactions know that you're going to be in this country or that country from this date to
this
date. I have to say, I was feeling very proud of myself on a trip a few years ago that I let the credit card companies know that, and somehow didn't make it quite all the way through my profile because the same thing happened and they weren't allowing things to go through. So it took another phone call, but it can't hurt. If you do it in advance, at least it's hopefully somewhere in your record.
Well, the last time I did it in advance, both a month and a half and then the week of leaving, and they still managed to mess up. And the UW Credit Union allows you to actually add that in as part of like almost like a message on their system for them to look at. So if they question anything, they can go in and see, oh, he is traveling.
So it kind of creates a flag on your account.
Versus I don't know how Visa, MasterCard do other than they say they're going to note it on their account. And they told me that, you know, 7 years ago, but it didn't matter because they still try to contact me here when I was overseas. So.
Yeah, that I had the exact same experience a few years ago, which isn't entirely helpful when you're on another continent. Well, I want to make sure people can join in and ask questions from Peter's personal experience or from just his vast knowledge of internet and computer issues. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 is the phone number. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Erica Janik is our on-air producer today, and she will be happy to answer the phone and get you through to us. So, Peter, it sounds like you did a fair amount of research before the trip. One of the things you did was to look up advisories for countries you were considering through the State Department. How useful is that?
You know, I initially signed up for it, and I had a little glitch with their system, so I contacted them, and they got back to me and, you know, told me how to deal with it because I was adding my kids to the travel profile. And then once I was able to complete it, at least I knew it was in their system. And if something was going to come up, and there were protests in Athens that we saw when we were there. You know, to say I felt safer, I just felt like, well, at least somebody, you know, knows about us other than, you know, my relatives and friends. They have hard information to deal with. You know, I put the links up there so people have access to it. It's pretty straightforward, but you got to make sure you got your information. And here's another thing. When you travel internationally, when you sit down and do the sign up for the tickets, you know, it's a lot easier if you've got all the passport information, all the birth dates, all the information you're going to need to key in, because as part of the check-in process for companies like EasyJet and Aegean Air and all the others that
are
overseas.
All the regional airports, Sam.
You're traveling internationally. They need passport information, and it just makes, you know, going through ticketing and so forth, just very easy. And to be honest with you, the only time we went through, I think it was like 7 airports, we had 4 international customs things to deal with. And I have to tell you, the worst was coming through on O'Hare, and someone said to me, well, wait till you have to go through Houston. And, you know, little things like, hey, maybe they should put, like, fans blowing on, you know, this huge crowd of people. They could have more than one person, you know, guiding people with, you know, the masses coming in. And, I don't know, they do retinal scans and fingerprinting, and it's so subjective, and I'm thinking, you know, why not have stations while you're going through the line because you're looking up stuff in a database? If you're really so concerned about this national security thing and you've got the sophisticated, you know, why are you using it subjectively? I could put on a different, you know, somebody else's face. You know, it just, I don't get some of the procedural things. But Heathrow, you know, is the largest international airport in terms of travelers coming through.
It being London.
In London. And, boy, just, you know, they make you walk a little longer, but it's pretty smooth.
Well, with the passport information, we'll move off of the travel things soon because people want to ask general computer questions, which they count on you for good advice. One of the things I've found is really useful is, you know, they always talk about carrying a copy of your passport in case it's lost.
Yep.
What I do is I scanned mm-hmm. my passport and emailed it to myself on my Gmail, so I can pick that up anywhere in the world. So if I have lost everything, mm-hmm. I can at least get online and get a copy of my passport. And, you know, you can also scan whatever, you know, and often you have, you know, your e-tickets because, you know, paper tickets for airplanes are pretty much non-existent at this point. You can still access your e-tickets that way, you know, and so having those things where you know you can pick them up wherever you need them is really
useful. Well, I think I've mentioned this numerous times over the years in terms of the smartphones and internet-enabled devices is actually having your own separate email account just for those devices so you can do exactly that. And that's what I did as well, so that you can access information that you can email to yourself and not worry about, well, I emailed it to myself, but then, you know, it's not there because you downloaded it to your desktop.
Right.
You know, it's going to a Gmail account, Hotmail, and so forth. Yep, definitely.
Great. All right. Well, we can certainly go back to some of the travel things if people have questions. And we'll definitely talk more about the security of paying for things online, because more and more we're doing that, not just for travel, but as you said, you know, buying computer equipment, buying
cloud computing.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. So why don't we go to the phone? We have Mark in Junction City with a question. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Hey, I got a couple elderly parents that have been asking for a laptop because they want to do just a little bit of internet cruising, you know, check their Yahoo mail, do a little genealogy search. It's not really worth it to me to spend $200-$400 for a new netbook or a laptop and then have them kind of throw it on the couch and I look at it. So my thought was I was going to buy a cheap used laptop, maybe $20-$30 that doesn't have anything on a hard drive. And I was looking for a recommendation on maybe a good, simple little free operating system, you know, some kind of Linux-based thing that I could dump on there that would work good, be easy, be clean, you know, support, you know, to go onto an empty hard drive, you know, still support Wi-Fi and a little internet cruising for them. So, you know, I'm trying to get away cheap. I'm not a bad son, but I want to spend money if they're going to, you know, use it for a cat scratcher a little later on. So what would you recommend as a good operating system, you know, just to, you know, download and stick on a cheap little laptop, and I can take my answer off.
Well, how old are your parents?
Well, they're in their 70s right now. I was actually thinking perfect for them would be a tablet, but that's just too much money for me to
invest. Well, the only concern I have is related to, you know, Ubuntu, which has been popularized by Dell, is a free Linux system, and there are some others out there, and they work well. The only concern I have is, you almost have to profile them in terms of what kind of things they like to do online, because you may find that the things that they like to do may not work as well because the web resources that they're accessing are keeping up to date with the technology, and they may not be able to, you know, experience it the way they're expecting to. I don't know if are they using it now? Are they accessing it?
They got a desktop that is in a different room, and they just don't feel like going into that room. They'd rather just plunk around in the living room while they're watching TV. You know?
Yeah, Sure. You know, if you use, you know, in using Wi-Fi, the newer laptops, which use typically B, G, and N, the signal is going to be received stronger. So, for example, I was surprised, but I have a little Toshiba netbook that I brought along on the trip, and also an iPad 2, and the netbook actually picked up the Wi-Fi better than the iPad. So even the little netbooks are very useful. You know, they come with 2 gigs of memory and 250 gigs hard drive. So I was using those for backups for pictures. Plus, we were watching some online TV shows that were recorded because everything else over there was in a foreign language.
It's all Greek to you.
It's all Greek to me.
I couldn't resist. Sorry.
So I guess my point is to really find out the things that they like to do online and then check them out and see, you know, if it's like really kind of old technology stuff that those websites are doing or whether or not they need to continually be updated with Flash or, you know, if there's some multimedia things they're doing. The laptops have really come down quite a bit in price, and I know you know, you said you hesitated spending, you know, $200-$400, but they really, you know, it's a pretty much a complete package, and you know, it's going to work for what's there today, and probably a little bit for tomorrow. You know, you get something that's technically an operating system that's free. You may not have all the plug-in things that you need for the laptop to get it to work. You know, you might find some frustration in trying to get it set up quickly. So, you know, you got to make sure you have all the device drivers for the free OS that you're using and, you know, before you strip it out and try to set it up. So there's a little bit of the frustration side versus this is going to be easier to use. It may cost a little bit more, but it might be more user-friendly for what they're trying to do as well.
And they might be able to use it more easily, which means that they might have fewer questions.
So, that's right.
So, yeah, yep. It sounds like it's a little bit of a trade-off. Thanks for that question, Mark. And actually, we had an email from Mike with a similar question. Looking for a good laptop for my youngest daughter who is starting college in the fall. Any thoughts?
Good laptop. Well, I would say that, you know, The Windows 7 operating system and the Apple operating system, they're both very comparable. Windows 7 fixed a lot of issues that were prior in Windows Vista's possession. So it's a stable operating system. In terms of memory, I would, you know, if you're going to use a 32-bit version, you can't go above 4 gigs of memory. If you use the 64, you can go above 4 gigs of RAM. So just, you know, paying attention to the fact that, you know, if you're buying extra memory for your computer and you're using a 32-bit operating system, you're not really taking advantage of it. You know, hard drives, you know, make sure, I would probably say at a minimum 250, maybe 320. 500, the price difference really isn't that great. If you can get something with a higher spin, that means the RPMs, it'll operate a little faster, like 7,200 RPMs considered a higher performance drive versus 5,400. So it might be a little bit more costly. Displays, you know, 15 inches is pretty easy to carry around. You start going above that, and it's kind of like lugging around a desktop replacement.
Well, and a lot of students bring their laptops to their classes even with to take notes and things like that.
Even with an Apple Mac Pro, you know, at 17, I don't really take it around. It's just not an enjoyable, you know, process to lug that around. And they're also very pricey. You can, you know, unless you're doing a lot with you know, graphics and video part, you need to be a little careful and pay attention with the laptop in terms of the video card that's in it, how much memory it has, whether it's 256, 512, 1 gig of onboard memory, or is it shared memory. The shared memory are typically the ones that are lower performance, and those will be in the lower cost laptops. You know, Blu-ray versus DVD burner, you know, that's going to add a little price difference. And
Blu-ray can play either Blu-ray discs or regular DVDs?
I'm pretty sure it can.
Whereas DVDs doesn't do the Blu-ray.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, Blu-ray recordable, they have such a thing, but that gets pricey too. So, you know, it goes back to what I've said for many, many years. You know, what are your needs, goals, and objectives? What are you going to use it for? You know, write down the list, find the software that's going to work for you, and then match it up to the hardware. And, you know, factor in, like, you know, things change, you know, what do you, you kind of do your own little crystal ball and see what you might be doing in a couple years.
And I would say, since it's for his daughter, asking her how she's going to use it, not how he thinks she's going to use it, to make
That's
sure.
That's right, yeah.
And also, I would recommend, you know, instead of necessarily buying one to send her off to school with, see what kind of discounts are available through the school that she's going to. They might have, you know, student discounts
that
you want to make sure you take advantage of if it's possible.
That's right.
Yep. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Our guest today is Peter Green of InfoStar. He comes by monthly to help with your personal computer problems. We hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're talking personal computers with Peter Green of InfoStar.com. You can go to the Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and follow a direct link to InfoStar. And you can also join in the conversation by email, talk@WPR.org, or a comment on the Facebook page, or calling in at 1-800-642-1234. And Peter, we have several people that want to talk with you, so let's go back to the phone and start with Sherry in Wausau. Hi, Sherry.
My call.
Hi.
I have a box that pops up that says system hibernation failed. So it won't go into hibernation. I'm having to turn it off every time that I leave it. And it says the device driver for the standard 101-102 key or Microsoft Natural PS/2 keyboard device is preventing the machine from entering hibernation. Please close all apps and try again. If problem persists, you may need to update the driver. So I'm not sure what they mean by close all apps. I thought I did that. And then to update the driver, what do I do for that?
You can go on. Which version of Windows are you using?
XP.
XP. You can go into the control panel. And go into, boy, they move all these things, and I've been working a lot on Windows 7, but I believe it's under Add Remove Programs, and then there's a Windows Update tab, and you can click on that and then go into and ask for system updates, and it might find that. If it doesn't find it through that way, you can also go into the control panel and then click on, I believe it's System Settings and then Device Manager, and click on the, there'll probably be a plus sign next to the keyboard, and if you click on that, it might give you options, or you might have to right mouse click on it and then click on it'll give you a choice of things to do. One of them will be to update the device driver. The other way to do that is to, you know, if you use Google or whatever search engine, is to type in, you know, updating, you know, device driver for, you know, your keyboard. You know, just give it right in the name of it, and it'll probably come back with, you know, some search results, which basically say, you know, this is how you do it.
Great. Hope that helps, Sherry. And let's go on to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter. I have a question for you. I currently use a iMac, and the browser I'm using is obviously Safari.
Right.
One of the issues I'm actually having with Safari is in the right top corner is the Yahoo toolbar. And from time to time when I search on the Yahoo toolbar, and then I, you know, click enter to go to that web page. Safari quits unexpectedly, and it seems to happen quite a bit. And what I've been doing is, you know, just like updating, you know, all the software, things like that. However, it still keeps doing it, and I'm not sure if you have run into that with Safari quitting unexpectedly using the Yahoo toolbar. Because if I go to like Google and I type something in, it never does it. It's only when I use that Safari Yahoo toolbar.
Right. I haven't personally experienced that, but I can tell you based on my experience in using Apple and applications, what you probably want to do is do a little search on how to remove the toolbar cleanly and then to reinstall it. There may be, you know, a glitch in the installation and you just have to redo it, but you need to find out all the necessary files to remove it from your system so that there's no, like, history that it can link up to. And that's what I would probably try first.
So you need to start with a completely clean slate.
That's right.
Yeah, okay, so just removing that Yahoo toolbar. Okay.
Right, but look for the procedure to make sure it's cleanly removed because there may be remnants on your system that you may not be aware of.
Okay.
But they can affect how it's responding.
And then if you try to reinstall it, it's going to see those things that you're not seeing.
That's right.
And you might have the same problems.
Yeah.
All right, I hope that helps, Mike, and good luck with that. Let's go to Brendan in Milwaukee. Hi, Brendan.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering, is there a way of optimizing the performance of a recently purchased Mac desktop computer? I just bought it late last year, and even within the last 6 months or so that I've owned it, it seems to just, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be performing as fast as when I first purchased it. So I find myself resetting Safari because I presume that the cache was too full, or is there a defragmenter for the Mac? I used to own a PC before.
Yeah. You know, I've never defragmented my Mac hard drive. Which Apple are you using?
It's I wrote it down because it's a 3.06 gigahertz Intel Core 2 Duo.
Okay.
A 20, the smaller of the two screen size choices.
Yeah, it's using a Unix based OS, which is usually pretty clean, and you know, that's why they switched over to that platform, because it works well with the high performance chips. Have you ever tested your internet speed? Is it issues with internet access, or is it issues with other applications that you're using?
Well,
the reason I mention that is twofold. One is there are certain applications that will work better with more RAM. So,
oh, I see.
So I don't know if you have 2 gigs of memory or 4 gigs of memory.
No, it's four gigabytes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that should be working fine. If it's internet applications that might be a concern that have slowed down, I tell people an important thing to not only do on your desktop or laptop that you use at home, but also on your smartphones, is to have an application that's called Speedtest. So if you go to speedtest.net, they have free applications for the iPad, the iPhone, and I'm sure other smart devices. But also as well for going to their website on your desktop, your laptop, you can check your internet speed for both upload, download, and upload. And the lower the ping number, the better. It may not necessarily have an effect on your actual download speed, but I can tell you the lower the ping number, the better. And then you'll see, you know, what kind, you know, if your internet service provider said, hey, I'm selling you 5 meg download, but you're only getting 1.5, well, then you're getting cheated, and you should be calling them back and having them figure out how to get closer to 5. And when they say 5, it's not exactly 5. It's typically in the acceptable range is considered 4 to 5, but not 1.5. That's way off.
Great. Thanks for that call, Brendan. And now let's switch over to Joyce in Madison. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. My question is for Peter, and how I understand all of the words that you're saying, except it's kind of in a foreign language.
Okay.
In terms of applying all of this information, I don't get what this stuff means. You know, I'm here talking Safari. I have no idea what that means. I'm getting that it must mean to speed things up and that kind of thing. Is there any place that an older adult can go and learn what does all this mean, and how can I apply it to, you know, buying a new laptop or user-friendly, that kind of stuff?
Sure.
Do I have to go, you know, to a tech school and take a course, or can I go to a vendor or a retail place and somebody's going to give me some, you know, everybody's going to give me a little bit of information, or I'm going to get, you know, the wrong information? I guess that's what I'm really concerned about, is getting the wrong information.
I think that's a really good question, Joy, and one that a lot of people would benefit from.
Yeah. So I take it you don't have a computer, correct?
I have a computer. It's actually sitting part on the counter and part on the sewing machine. It's not plugged in and put together.
All right.
I do use a computer at school. I teach part time. So I get, you know, I can get email, and I can Google and you know, search for information that way.
Okay.
But I don't really know, you know, like if I wanted to go out and buy a laptop, I don't know, you know, gigabyte this, little byte that. I don't understand, you know, all what I could possibly what my needs are.
Right.
So that's pretty much my question. I mean, it really sounds naive and really basic, but that's kind of where I'm working from, is that basic knowledge of, you know, so many people come to buying computers and using computers because they've had them in college, and when I went to college, you know, hey, there weren't any computers.
No, I think that's a really good question, Joy, and I think it's similar, Peter, to whenever you want to, you know, start something new, a new sport, a new activity, where do you get good information? And I think with computers, it can be a little overwhelming because there is so much jargon around it.
Yep.
And also, a lot of people do know a lot about it. Like Joy was saying, a lot of, you know, kids especially have literally grown up with it. Mm-hmm. Those of us where computers were coming in more during college, you know, we kind of made the switch then. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a lot of people that could benefit from that kind of basic training and then moving on from there.
Yeah. What's interesting is the wide variety of calls that we get on this show. And, you know, we handle stuff from anywhere from people using Macs and PCs and laptops and all different operating systems. And then we get calls for people trying to set up websites and doing things with their email. And, you know, Facebook is mentioned not only in this show, but it's mentioned on other shows that have been done. So it's just this wide variety, and you get almost each operating system and each computer has its own specific terminology. Like, you know, Apple is typically Safari-based, you know, using Safari for a web browser. But you can also get Safari for the PC, but it's not typical. So I think when the people call in and ask questions and they're talking about their own specific issues, for someone to listen in that doesn't really have a lot of computer experience, or maybe they've been exposed to a lot of computers, but if you're not paying attention to what's on those systems, you're not going to feel comfortable or familiar with, you know, the terminology that someone's using to describe an Apple issue versus a PC or a laptop issue, or in a network environment, or talking about the cloud. You know, what is the cloud? And part of me laughs about people talking about the cloud and it being secure. And it also goes back to years ago when people talked about switching over to these IP phone systems. There are advantages and disadvantages to everything that we keep inventing technology-wise, and you have to find the right fit. So how do you find out more about what you hear? One is going to taking a class, whether it's through a computer vendor or a tech school, taking an entry-level class, and then talking to people, you know, when you take breaks and asking questions, you know, things that you may not be familiar with, because there is no dumb question. There really is no dumb question. And maybe taking it for the Apple and taking it for the PC and you know, having a little bit more firsthand experience comparing the two systems. The other is that the dummy books that they've written, I think it's McGraw-Hill, but I could be wrong. There's a wide variety of topics that those cover. And then there are also another set of O'Reilly books that are called Missing Manuals that are also, you know, well-written for helping people with not only computers, but iPhones, iPads, smartphones, and so forth. And then the other thing is using a resource like YouTube, which allows you to actually experience either seminar environments, speaker environments where people have given talks at conferences to share information, or someone trying to promote their web resource of tutorials that they may have come up for a specific product or a way of doing something. And I'm not talking about just computers. I'm talking about for, you know, anything you can think of.
I've learned a lot of my knitting from YouTube.
Yeah, is to go on YouTube and look and see what kind of information people are sharing out there. It's invaluable. And I've learned how to use software that way.
And I would say, too, Joy's in Madison, but I'm sure this would apply to people wherever they're listening, calling your library. Libraries are an incredible resource. And I know especially when computers were even newer than they are now, they did a lot of, you know, classes that people could sign up for. If they're not running classes now, librarians know a whole lot about what's going on in communities, so they can be a good resource. Also, senior centers quite possibly have information about things like that, too. Whether or not you're an official senior, Joy, I think they would probably know for those people that this is not second nature for where to find those things.
Here's one more. Is online, there's a resource called Wikipedia, and what you can do is search that and then read about not only what you're looking for, but the history behind it. So, for example, if you have an interest in, you know, collecting a certain car, so you type in the car, and you'll get the history of, you know, how that started and, you know, the people that developed the engine and, you know, the history on the company, and they'll have all these links. And you could spend endless amount of time just looking on one little item that people have contributed to. So the world really is a book, and you have access to that, and it's free.
So for
as
instance,
long as you have computer access to it.
And the library, again, is a great resource for that. Again, for something like that, like looking up something on Wikipedia, Joy, if you look up, say, internet browsers, and it'll probably list Safari and Firefox and Internet
Explorer.
And
it'll tell you about Cello and Mosaic and a bunch of others. And Cello, Cello was actually invented or developed at Cornell, and it was one of the first web browsers for the internet. And a little tidbit, the internet is a network of computers. The web is the graphical user interface to web servers on the internet. So there is a difference between the two.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Joy. I think that was a really good topic to cover. And let's go on to Cecilia in Waukesha. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi. I have a two-part question. I got a call from a friend of mine that I had sent her an email, which I hadn't even sent any that week. And I think what happened is something attached itself to my email account and took all the addresses out of my address. And when I actually went in and looked, it sent like 400 emails out. And I have AOL. When I called them, all they could tell me was to change my password. And I was trying to figure out, isn't there some way that I can A, trace whatever robot piracy thing did that, and B, all my other spam that I try and opt out of, when I click on opt out, it won't let me. I like red flag them, and I wanted to find some way to contact them or report somewhere that, you know, I don't want email from them, and please, like, prosecute or something, or just stop sending me all the spam. And I use, for security, I use on my home computer, but I don't have internet at home anymore, I use a Microsoft program, but I'm going to a shelter, the library, and my computer at work, and I have security issues because I don't want to infect the computer at work because it's a security site.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what my questions are about, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Well, if you want to, it sounds like you're using an AOL email account?
Yes.
And are you downloading the messages to your system, or are you accessing the account online?
Online. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I open them on occasion. Most of the time I just delete them.
Okay.
when I open them, I'm trying to get to the box that says unsubscribe or opt out, mm-hmm. or sometimes I'll hit reply and I'll put unsubscribe me.
Right.
But there'll be like a link on there for unsubscribe, and I'll try and hit it, and
right.
it won't do anything. Right click,
right.
left click, nothing. It won't let me opt out.
Mm-hmm.
And the particular one was very embarrassing. It sent an email for erectile dysfunction to some nuns in Chicago, and I wasn't too happy about that.
Right. Well, let's see. What I would probably do is do some research with the AOL email and sending unsolicited spam email and looking into what kind of answers you get back in the search links, and try and ask the question better to see either what subtle change you can make to AOL in terms of settings, or what someone was able to do to actually, you know, eliminate having that an issue. Because technically, AOL being in control of the email environment should, one, be able to set up spam filters, and number two, it should eliminate being infiltrated by, you know, someone that's using your email to relay or send out blanket emails, you know, of 400 or so. So there's something going on with AOL that's been compromised with your account, and you need to, you know, figure out how to get the settings right.
It sounds, though, Peter, from what Cecilia was saying, that she's actually going into the spam emails and clicking on links to try to unsubscribe.
Right.
My understanding
is
that
not letting her.
But on spam emails, you really don't want to interact with them at all, right? Isn't it better to just...
No, almost all my email goes into my spam account. Mm-hmm. Even things that I've signed up for, it all goes into my spam folder. Almost nothing goes into my new mail.
Wow. Well, maybe your filter is set a little... Maybe it's set a little high. If even are even good emails going there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there you probably set something too high.
Oh, but, so I should go in and change my change the filter level too.
Yeah.
But AOL didn't want to do anything because it was a free account.
Yeah, that's you get. You get limited help when things are free and they don't want to pay attention too much, which can also be frustrating. That's why, you know, if you go online and do some searching and mention, you know, free AOL account, email account, just get better at asking that question. You'll probably find people that have found solutions and workarounds to what you're going through.
Well, and I've heard, Peter, that Gmail has pretty good filters. And so I've heard of people actually... basically having other email accounts forward through Gmail mm-hmm. to kind of have that second layer of filtering. And I find Gmail really easy to use, so I like it for those other reasons. But it mm-hmm. seems like they also have a little better, or they're more on top of the filtering.
I've had one of my Gmail accounts, and I really don't get much junk coming into that. I don't even think I get any junk coming into it.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I would agree with that.
All right. We are talking with Peter Green of Infostar.com. He comes by monthly to help us with personal computer problems. And you can join in. The phones are full for the moment, but we should probably have some open lines soon. You can call 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We're talking personal computers with Peter Green of Infostar.com. And Peter, as always, we have a lot of people who want to join in on the conversation. So let's go to Bruce in La Crosse. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. Quick question. I'm running a Sony F-Series laptop. And for a while now, I had been using Orbit Downloader to grab videos from YouTube, sometimes primarily from some science magazines. Instructional videos that I want to have on file for various purposes. And I don't know, the other day I got a thing that I could update to Windows Explorer 9, and I thought, well, okay, you know, so I did. And that went well, but now, just this morning, I noticed I'd gone to Astronomy Magazine to download or grab a video on some information, and I don't any longer get my little grab-it bar that appeared previous, and there seems to be no way that I can make this thing work. Is there any kind of a conflict between Orbit Downloader and Internet Explorer 9?
Sounds to me like...
No, I'm sorry.
It sounds to me like you found it.
Oh. Hey. I have some friends that are sort of, you know, relatively more knowledgeable about this than I am, and of course everybody has their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody says, why in the heck are you using Internet Explorer? You should be using Google Chrome.
Right.
Why are you using Explorer? You should be using Safari. Why the heck are you using Windows 7?
Right.
You should be using Ubuntu. And,
right.
And it's like, no, you know.
Everybody's got an opinion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it worked. The only thing is, it worked with, I believe the previous version, I'm assuming it must have been Internet Explorer 8, and it worked just fine, and I built up a nice library of material,
mm-hmm.
and now it doesn't seem to function anymore.
Well, how long have you had Explorer 9 on your system?
Oh, just a couple of days.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you've got your system restore set up on your computer, you can go back prior to Windows Explorer 9 installation and, you know, just go back to the way you were before.
That basically, when I got Internet Explorer 9 on there,
uh-huh.
the only real big notice I could find was most of the stuff on the left side of the screen was now on the right side of the screen.
Uh-huh.
And it really didn't seem worth the trade-off to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But, okay, yeah, I that's a good idea. I'll just tune it back and see if that straightens it out.
But I would also recommend that you probably download and install at least one or two other browsers. Google Chrome is a leaner browser, and also something like Mozilla Firefox, which is pretty standard. But and the reason I mention this, and I've talked about this numerous times, is it's always good to have an alternative web browser to use in case you're having problems with the primary one. So it used to be that you had to do all your updates with Microsoft using Internet Explorer. Maybe things are slowly changing over time, but, you know, having more than one web browser that you can at least explore other options with to research problems is very helpful to have. And it doesn't take a long time to, unless you've got a slow download connection.
Thanks for that call, Bruce. And let's move on to Miles and Nina. Hi, Miles.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. I have a tidbit more of an advanced question compared to what everybody else is asking, but I still think it's a pretty prevalent one into what other people are thinking.
Okay.
Basically, I'm wondering about security.
Mm-hmm.
I have, like, the basics, just like a firewall, actually zone alarm free.
Okay.
And I've done some research and everything, but I'm just wondering, like, how to bring it one step further. I know some people... to use specific like port blockers, or even to go as far as to say to use like a proxy mm-hmm. that they work off of, because I've noticed even through the firewall sometimes viruses can get into it and then just allow itself, give itself the permission and just bypass the firewall. So I was wondering if maybe you knew of maybe a simpler way to maybe take that firewall or security in general and take it one step further.
Well, there are a number of ways to add more security. One is actually using your router, which the newer ones have built-in features for doing firewall and security control. So that would probably be a better solution than using some of the freeware that's out there. The other thing is the Windows 7 firewall has gotten better. It used to be basically getting in the way, but it allows you to program it with exceptions, and then it tells you, you know, when it's going to block something. It gives you some warning. But the more sophisticated security issues that are dealt with are typically going to come from the hardware side, using router or managed switches for security, so that they block, you know, you can actually see traffic. It gives you reports and it tracks things like that.
Okay, so to configure that, when you set up routers, you do the simple, you go in and then you set up your web password and all that, and it's got a bunch of different... options. Is that usually where it is when you...
That's right. When you set up a router, so whether you get one from D-Link, Linksys, Netgear, Cisco, Vizio, so forth, you're going to have a login. And when you log in, there's usually, they may list it as security, or they may list it as advanced options. You know, it comes under a variety of things. But when you log into that device, that's when you have your opportunity to make the changes and see where things are happening. It can give you, you know, the time that the device started. It can, you know, map the ports. But you have to do some research to find whether or not your device has that feature in it, because, you know, not all devices that you buy have those things built into them. That's what you pay a little extra for.
Thanks for that call, Miles. And Peter, we are going to be talking for another half hour with you shortly. I want to let people know they're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week so Larry can have a little time off. I hope he's enjoying himself. Peter Green's here with us every month talking about personal computers. And today we're also talking about what he learned planning a trip overseas. So we'll definitely touch on that too after we come back from the news. Please stay tuned. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and joined by Peter Green of Infostar.com. He comes by about once a month to share great information and news about personal computers and using the web. And I just want to let people know, because, Peter, I know some people mark their calendars for when you're going to be on. We're actually giving you July off, since the first Monday of the month is July 4th. So Peter will be back on August 1st. So a little bit of a hiatus, but not too much, and you can just save up all those questions for him. We definitely want to get back to the phone soon, because people have been waiting to talk with you, Peter, but I want to follow Larry's tradition of, right after the noon news, talking about your top 10 plus list of websites for the month. And we did start out talking a lot about the travel resources that you provided, but there's at least one or two that I want to make sure that we draw people's attention to. One is Booking.com. That's a Priceline company, and it's a travel resource to help book and reserve travel. And it can include to have free cancellation. You pay a little more, but it's kind of an insurance. What did you like or not like so much about that site?
Well, let me go through the list, and,
sure,
and I'll cover that part. An interesting little tidbit that I didn't put in there. We had a layover in Dulles Airport in D.C., and if people don't know about this, we had a significant layover. I think it was like probably about 6 hours. And I went to the information. I said, what can we do? And he said, oh, you can take a 50-cent shuttle to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum one way, you know, and then 50 cents coming back. And they got a timetable. And it was phenomenal. And we had an absolute blast seeing, you know, just all the history with air and space. I mean, they got space shuttle there. They got the stealth fighter jet. It's just really, you know, so if you have a layover there, take advantage of that, because it really is a gift, and there's no admission to it. And if you got carry-on luggage, you got lockers to put stuff in, so you don't have to walk around with it.
And I'll actually add one thing there. If you're if you fly into Reagan National, which is also on, it's right on the Metro line, as is the Smithsonian stop. I think it's on the same line. Mm-hmm. You can hop on a Metro, get to the Smithsonian campus and back really easily. So
yes, and there it's a great way to just, you know, enjoy time and mm-hmm. do that stuff.
A lot more interesting and so, and makes the time go faster.
Yep. So they're all on Infostar.com. Go to the current top 10 or the archives in today's date. The first one is travel.state.gov. And, you know, if you go there, you'll see I use their STEP program, like I mentioned before. The Booking.com Priceline company, I experienced it. I used it a lot. It's not without flaws. I had one keeper hotel owner actually charge in advance, but I was fine with it because the way the euro converted, to me it was like a discount, so I said, let it go. You know, we're still coming. And another one, made a mistake of not having a refundable booking, and, you know, it's written in stone with these corporate places, so you got to be careful of that. You know, people don't make mistakes. You know, corporations don't make mistakes. You know, that kind of thing. So anyhow, no leeway with that. Ebookers.com, I use that. It's an overseas booking site that I used when I couldn't complete my booking on Aegean Airlines, which I was doing directly because of the handshaking problem with the Visa card. Mm-hmm. So I circumvented that by going through eBookers, which had no knowledge of my issues with the Visa card, which was not my problem. It was Visa having a problem with me buying the tickets. CarHire3000.com is a resource I happen to find that is not one of the larger ones out there, but it's basically a car rental, car for hire online resource, and they're based in the UK, and they got me the best rate, and it was actually through Avis. I had an interesting situation where I was renting the car on the island of Rhodes but returning it on Santorini, and I contacted Hertz. I even called them here, and I said, I can't complete this on your website. This is what I want to do, but I know you're at both locations. Can you help me? Sure, we'll call you back. They never called. And then Avis was able to do it, and they were in both locations. So anyhow, that's how that goes. GreekTravel.com is number five, but it's really an indication to just show you the people that travel these regions. Wherever you go, you'll probably find someone that is a guide that has done these areas enough times to provide resources with you. And there are numerous ones I listed just to give you a demonstration of what people have done out there. But I can also tell you that some of them do referrals to hotels that they frequent and actually can get you a discount versus like Booking.com or Orbitz, which does not give you a discount. So, and I checked it out. I went to Booking. I said, okay, can I get it? No, and the other one, it works. So that's up there. Google Earth, I mentioned before. And, you know, if you're using a ferry, you can book the ferries online. They've got English translations. You just got to figure out what port to what port and, you know, the car and how many people. The Frommer's and Lonely Planet, number seven. I also purchased inexpensive books from eBay and Amazon. Used books, great condition, fraction of the cost. Just take along. They're nice things to read. And also reading the reviews on the hotels that you're staying at. And not just looking at the first page, but go through them. And also the blogs and the review guides to see places that you might like to stay at. Because I changed one of my hotels based on the fact that they said, if I came back here, I would stay in this region, this area, because you can experience this and this is what goes on. I thought, well, then that's where I want to be. So you find out that stuff. If you're a scuba diver, of course, Paddy.com is something you're familiar with. If you're not, you know, scuba diving all over the world, this is a great resource to find out more, because there's a lot. We've got more water than we have land, so figure that one out. And then ChooseMyPlate.gov was just announced. Say goodbye to the food pyramid. And up north, the loonwatch.org. You know, the beautiful bird up there, and you know, lots of information on that too.
Great. As always, tons of great information, and that top 10 list should carry us through till August, I'm guessing. Well, Peter Green of InfoStar is here with us, and a lot of people want to join in the conversation. So let's go to Bob in Green Bay. Hi, Bob. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I've got a problem with the security warning that keeps popping up when I try to upload my own pictures onto eBay.
Okay.
I'm in the eBay, you know, program to do a listing, and I click open my browser. And as soon as I do that, a box opens up asking if I want to allow this. And I say I do, and then within 2 seconds, it pops up again before I can pick up my picture.
Mm-hmm.
And within that box, there's also a box to check, don't show this again, but that's never active. It's never clickable.
Yeah, if you go into your internet browser, there's, I believe it's under options, there's a security setting that you can change, and you probably just have it too high. So that
okay.
you need to change that setting, and then you probably won't see that warning.
Okay, is there some reason the box don't show this again doesn't open up?
Microsoft's kind of helter-skelter on that. You know, there are times where you say, hey, don't bother me, and it doesn't. And then there are times you say, don't bother me, and it keeps asking
you. They're not sure they believe you.
They're not sure they believe you. Yes.
Okay, good luck with that, Bob. And Matt in Fond du Lac, let's move on to you. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
Hi.
A couple of things. I believe her name was Joy, looking for information. AskALibrarian.com has been very helpful for me.
Great.
A lot of times they don't get back to you the same day, but they usually do within 24 hours. There's a gal that had a problem with the with AOL, where her contact list was copied and robotic information was sent out. If I remember right, because I used to use AOL, go under your tools on your webpage, activate your phishing filter. That usually helps. You will have to change your password, though. A good suggestion is people that are in your contact list, if it's something from you or you've had this problem before, make sure that you add something like a specific name, even if it's a bunch of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, something that can be agreed upon. And if with their security setting really high, I found you can on websites that you visit a lot, you can list that exceptions, and it will go into your inbox, and with a phishing filter on, it'll help protect the computer as well.
Thanks. Thanks for those
all good
points.
Suggestions.
Did you have a question yourself, Matt, or were you just helping everybody else?
I have a question myself. Something I've run into that I've never come across before on an XP Home Edition 933 Ampereon with a 133 FSB. The half a gig of memory. 3.1 update, which was over a year ago. I've been working on this thing for a year. You start it up, and the coffee cup holder sticks his tongue out at you for about 5 minutes straight. And when if you restart the computer, it goes to a checking files and folders page. And, you know, it's suggested that you go ahead and do this. So I usually let it do it. And the only problem is, as soon as it's done, I lose all control of my mouse. The mouse is not recognized. The keyboard is there, but not the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
I've never run into that before, especially with XP.
Hmm. Have you tried a different mouse on it? It sounds to me like it's dealing with the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
In that it's taking so long and it's trying to negotiate it's trying to handshake the devices. So mm-hmm. you may want to see if you're plugging your mouse and your keyboard into the mouse and keyboard ports, you may want to try and see if you can use the USB ports on the computer.
Using a PS2
right.
keyboard, and yep. I know that's plugged into the keyboard connection. The USB is connected. There are four USB ports
right.
Below that, and I started out inadvertently mm-hmm. when I first got the computer, plugging it into one of the USB connectors below the PS2 for the keyboard,
right.
And, I didn't have anything, so I shut the computer off and moved it over one column of USB connections. It worked fine. And then just one day, I drive semi, so I'm gone all week. And on the weekend, I went home, fired this thing up, and it started doing that.
Yeah, well, sometimes the devices themselves go bad, or sometimes the ports go bad for whatever reason. And it doesn't take much for them to be off. So one is to change a device and use the same port and see if that fixes it. And the other one is to move it to a different port before you change the device and see if that fixes it.
Hope that works for you, Matt. And we had an email from Dan going back to the question that the caller had about those spam emails and clicking on trying to unsubscribe and it not working. Dan mentioned spammers use the unsubscribe option to identify valid email addresses so they know that it's actually a good email that they're sending to. If you click on that button, on a spam, you'll end up with more spam in the future because your address will have been sold or traded. And he's suggesting only use unsubscribe on a legitimate email. And I think, you know, most of us can kind of see it might be not something we asked for, but it's not necessarily spam in the true sense of it.
That's right. Yeah.
Great,
and,
thanks
and
for that.
And they are always looking to see if they're hitting valid emails.
Right, and if they can prove that it's valid, then they can sell it on. So very good point, Dan. Thanks so much for adding that. Let's go to Barb in Dodgeville next. Hi, Barb.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Hello to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. My husband and I installed a second personal computer at home, a desktop, and the original computer, we moved out into a library area and put a wireless router in the second or the original computer. And when we did that, the original computer that we moved out into the library area, when we open emails now that have links and you try to click on the link, it says, contact your system administrator. And my question is, how do I fix that?
Okay. The computer that you moved,
yes,
that you're having that message come up,
yes,
is that hardwired? Or
no, that has the router, the wireless router.
Okay. Is it a laptop?
Nope, that's a desktop also.
Okay. So you need to have a wireless card that goes into that desktop that would allow you to take advantage of the wireless router, because there's no way for that to receive the signal unless it has a wireless network adapter in it to receive it.
How old a computer is that, Barb?
Well, it's only about 3 years old. It's mm-hmm. working, and mm-hmm. I'm able to get emails and access the internet. But I can't, when I receive an email, I can't click on a link in that email to open up the link. It's some security setting, I think.
Oh, there's a setting within, if you've already got that set up and it's working probably, but that link isn't going through, there's a setting typically in whatever email that you're using that allows you to make that active.
Oh.
So it's under, you have to hunt for it under options and settings or preferences to make the link in your email active.
And so that's the preferences within the email program.
Correct.
That she's using.
Yep.
Okay. Well, yep. Dumb me. I should have figured that one out. I really appreciate that.
Now,
Thank you.
Do you have your wireless? Is it secure?
It is.
Okay, good.
Peter just likes to make sure everybody's on the right page. Thanks so much for that, Barb, and happy surfing now that you can get to those links. Peter, let's take that opportunity actually to talk a little bit about wireless routers. What kind of security do you recommend?
Well, one that you can remember so that, you know, it's not a when you set up an SSID, that means you're broadcasting the name. Typically, you broadcast the name of what you call your network. You can do a wide variety of encryptions in terms of being secure, but it is nice to know what it is. If someone comes over and visits and you want to give it to them, not to give them some crazy
24
combination,
numerical,
24 characters with upper, lowercase and all different, you know, making it something for you to remember, easily remember, so it can be used rather than be a point of frustration. And ones that I've used that I found very useful, in terms of ease of setting up is, Vizio puts out a dual band, router for wireless, you know, internet access. And, it's very easy to set up and there are a lot of options to it as well. So, and it's inexpensive. I think it's like maybe $60-$70. So.
And what are the risks if your wireless network is unsecured?
Unsecure. There's a term called war driving. And basically, I mean, if you went out of your way and you linked up your drives to share them and made them freely accessible, which is not typical and it's not a default setting. And there are people talk about being backdoors to gaining access to that. But realistically, people having fun with doing what's called war driving and going around and seeing what kind of unsecure wireless Wi-Fis are around there and accessing the internet and how fast they can do it. And but you walk around a neighborhood, most neighborhoods have secure Wi-Fi. I think the word has gotten out there to do that.
And I know we've had some questions in the past, and so it's something that people wonder about. If you have an unsecured Wi-Fi connection at your home, is there any way for people to infiltrate your computer, for viruses to get in, things like that?
Not really for infiltrating, but more for just sharing your internet access. And, you know, the further the distance, the harder, the weaker the signal. So, you know, it's how much of that bandwidth you're really giving away. As far as viruses and gaining access to, you know, financial information, again, you really got to be sophisticated with trying to break through a back door and getting into someone's system. That's not a typical occurrence.
So maybe if you're at the IMF or something, that's a concern. Probably not just on a residential home computer, I'm guessing.
No.
Great. Let's go to Dave in Mount Horeb. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon. I'm calling on behalf of my wife. She has a netbook that's about a year old. It's a Dell. And my daughter did something, and now my wife can't get to the Windows 7, the Windows XP.
So you mean it doesn't come up?
Yep. I mean, it comes on to the initial screen, and that's as far as it comes.
Huh.
It doesn't go to the XP, and she's tried some stuff. I can't tell you exactly what she did because she was doing it, not me. And I'm wondering what, if anything, she could try to get the operating system back online.
Well, one thing is to look up online as related to the model that you're using and see if there is a way, you know, what procedure they use for, possibly resetting the system. That's one thing that you should find out. The other is when it's trying to boot up Windows XP, as it says, right before it says starting Windows or right at that occurrence, is to hit the F8 function key and try to see if you can get it to come up in the safe mode and see if that works. And then maybe try to do, after you get it to restart, see if it comes back up to the desktop that way. Most netbooks don't come with, they're smaller laptops, so they come without CDs or DVDs. So if you have to do a repair to it, you need to have a way to use the XP disk or operating system to talk to that drive to do a repair to the disk. And the only way to do that is to have some kind of external drive that you can use an XP disk to, you know, read off of. So that gets a little bit more complicated.
Because we have several computers around the house that have XP on them.
Right, but you actually need
the
disk itself, because there's a repair procedure that you can follow, and you can look online. There are several sites with doing Windows system repair, and they talk about how to actually do it, but you need access to the XP disk being loaded off of a DVD drive to be able to talk to the computer. And with
I probably have an XP disk someplace.
Right.
But do I have to have the one for that particular XP version?
You may be able to get away with not having it for that one, but you may want to, check and see with the manufacturer of the netbook if you're able to try and do that. Because they have different versions of the OS for the netbooks where they scale them down.
And with that, we are at the end of our show. Peter Green of InfoStar, thanks so much for coming by, and we will see you again on Monday, August 1st.
It was great. Thank you.
And I just want to let you know, tomorrow at 11, we'll be talking about autism spectrum disorders with a medical researcher and with the author of a young adult novel whose protagonist has Asperger's syndrome. I certainly hope you'll join me. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller.